Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we are discussing Psalm for the Wild Built by Becky Chambers. Hello and welcome to History in Reverse. My name is Caroline. I'm here with my father, Richie.
Oh, hi.
You have to say hi.
Hi.
Today we're talking about a really cool short. Is it a novella?
It's a novella.
Technically a novella called Psalm for the Wild Built by Becky Chambers. That, Dad, I think you read it first, right?
Yes, I read it first. And
then you told me about it, and I was like, huh, that's a really interesting idea. And then I said, let's do it for the podcast. So right. That's where we are. That's how we got here. That's how we're all here together. What you told me about the book that got me interested in it was that it was about a monk who, a world where robots live in the wild.
Right.
And a monk who goes into the wilderness and meets a wild robot. And I was like, that's really interesting. That's like a really unique concept. I hadn't heard really of anything like that before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what interested me about it. And it's a good book. It's very good. Strong recommend. Anyone who's listening, it's short. And the writing is phenomenal. But before I get too much into it, do you want to talk about the author?
Right. So if you really want to read the book, you don't want any spoilers, although that's the story is not that complicated anyway. You go and read the book and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
So Becky Chambers is a fairly new science fiction writer. She was born in the 80s, like 85 or something. And mm-hmm. this particular book was published last year. 2021, and there's already a sequel, so there's a second book with the same character,
which is that's odd to me because this feels complete. But
I think she won a Hugo Award for this one. Now she also wrote another series called the Wayfarer series, which is Wayfarer is the name of a spaceship, and this kind mm-hmm. of mock a crew of a bunch of different races doing. Deconstruct wormholes. That's the job.
Oh, that's cool.
And
maybe I'll read some more by her. Yeah.
Yeah. So I read the first book, and the first book, the interesting thing about that first book that she self-published it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she did a Kickstarter campaign and she self-published it, and then was picked up by a publisher and did well enough that she wrote like four other books, basically the same set of characters. I just found out today that this Psalm for the Wild Built is an example of solar punk. And you were explaining to me what solar punk is.
Yeah, it definitely is. So I think solar punk is a lot less common than what we're used to, which would be steampunk. So most people right. have a concept of what steampunk is.
Oh, cyberpunk.
But basically, cyberpunk's another good example. I was trying to think of another one. So steampunk, I mean, basically anytime you take like a way to power something, and like the technology around that and make it like science fiction-y in some fashion, you've created, you know, X-punk. So steampunk is like Victorian era stuff that had like kind of is around the time of the steam engine, right? That's kind of where steampunk
right.
comes from.
Right.
Cyberpunk, a really good example of cyberpunk is the game Cyberpunk, which came out 2 years ago.
Well,
cyberpunk is like far future, like, Futurama is kind of cyberpunk.
Futurama is kind of cyberpunk. Neuromancer is the...
Neuromancer is a good example of cyberpunk, absolutely. Solarpunk is things sort of kind of around like solar power and things that are...
Sustainable technology.
Right, sustainable technology and still kind of tapping into science fiction-y kind of technology right. because... Steampunk is past technology. Cyberpunk is like full science fiction technology, like things that are like mm-hmm. like way like past us. Solarpunk kind of is technology we kind of have, but like maybe a little bit more advanced. A good example of it is Disney animated movie Treasure Planet, which is based on the book Treasure Island. Treasure Planet has a solarpunk, I would say, is a solarpunk style to it. The ships are ships that go through space have solar sails that make the ship propel because they absorb the sunlight. Like right. it's all kinds of stuff like that. So that's cool. I hadn't thought about the fact that it was solar punk, but I like that a lot.
This was the first time I heard about it. So that's about to make sense.
But I think overall, just like to say at the outset, the writing in this is phenomenal and it's hilarious.
There's many interesting things about it. So like one of the things we always talk about, how the author introduces the setting and he wants to give you background of the world. So in this one, there's yet another way. The author basically quotes from some historical work that describes this planet. And I love the very first sentence of the introduction, which is, if you ask six different monks the question, which godly domain robot consciousness belongs to, you'll get seven different answers.
Yes.
It's like right away, it's like, there's what? And this introduction, which is just a few pages, it's from Brother Gill, From the Brink, a spiritual retrospective on the factory age and the early transition era.
And what's great about that intro, and what's great about, I think, all of the writing in the story, is that there's no wasted space in the story. Like every word, every sentence is teaching you something in a very natural, organic kind of way. You know, like you read that and you get so much about the society just from that line, right? Like the fact that they're, you know, extremely philosophical and they're concerned about philosophy and they're concerned about the meaning of what they're doing and the purpose of what they're doing. And at the same time, you get the fact that there are conscious robots, and you get the fact that there was a factory age and there's a new age. And they're like, you get like all of this kind of packed very tightly into this very short narrative and like in very small spaces. So like kudos to her, because that's hard stuff and that's awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, she describes this religion with like six different schools of thought. And then you get an inkling from the introduction that there was something called the factory age. The robots became conscious and they decided to separate, but the humans lived in one spot and the robots went into wilderness.
What's interesting about it though is that we don't get like straight up exposition like that very much. So like in a book like Solaris, for example, because we covered Solaris previously, we get large sections of Solaris that are just exposition. Or a book like 1984, like in the middle of 1984, he sits down and reads a book, right? It's just exposition. Right. It's just the author saying, look at this cool world I made. Like, I'm going to tell you all about it in great detail. And they're very excited. They want to tell you. What Becky Chambers does here, which I think is probably the more effective storytelling method, is instead of just providing like chunks of exposition, she weaves that information into the actions that are happening, you know? Because like a lot of stuff happens in the story. There's a lot of events that occur. You learn like about the six gods, for example, throughout the whole story up until the very end, like at the end when they get into the monastery and they sort of have the six gods there. And do I totally understand every aspect of all the gods? No. But do I need to understand the story? No. All I need to know is it's important to Sibling Dex.
Right.
The way that she did that really is phenomenal. I know that's what a lot of the writing is. It's very funny and very accessible in a lot of ways. Mm. So I thought that was great. The way she did that.
So you mentioned Sibling Dex. Who's this person?
Sibling Dex. So Sibling Dex uses they, them pronouns. We're going to do our best to respect the fictional character of Sibling Dex.
So
Sibling Dex.
Sibling Dex is a monk, and monks are usually brothers or sisters. Mm-hmm. So in this case, he's a sibling.
They're a sibling. It's okay. We'll get there. I have trouble with it too. It's okay. We'll manage. They're a sibling, which is very interesting because I think that sets the story apart in a lot of ways. It's very modern in that way.
Right.
Like particularly in like science fiction, because even if you look at the history of science fiction and like all the stories we've covered, the closest we ever had a character that was someone without gender or who was non-binary or third gender was the character from Winter, the Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness.
Right.
But that character changed sex.
Well,
that
also the guy from All You Zombies, which was all the sexes.
That character changed gender, though. It's like it's different. So it's like that's the closest we got. Like they actually physically changed their sex and then also changed their gender to match.
Right.
But that's the closest you get. Like even in, you know, Star Trek, you know, all the five main Star Treks up until, I haven't watched the new ones now, you know, you don't really have, I mean, you have characters that play with gender on occasion, but you pretty much stick to male, female, and even then all the alien species they encounter do too, right?
Right.
So, it, I mean, it's a base dichotomy that's so fundamental, it's hard to question. So I think the fact that she not only questions it in this, but questions it with her main character.
Well, she doesn't question it, she just makes the main character being right. A sibling.
Right, exactly. And they and then they talk about it with Moscap, which we will get to shortly.
We'll get to that.
Yeah. So yeah, Sibling Dex is a monk. And I forget what they do in the beginning of the story. What kind of monk are they when it starts?
So he's just a monk in a monastery in a city. Mm-hmm. And the book begins where he's really unhappy. He just realized he wanted to be a monk and do all those nice things, but he's really unhappy. He wants to just mm-hmm. do something different. And actually, I don't know if you noticed, but the dedication of the book from the author, it says, for anybody who could use a break.
Yeah. I think that's the ultimate point of the story. Sometimes you need a vacation.
Sibling Dex decides that he's kind of tired of being a monk, and he wants to become a tea monk. So this is the story takes place on a moon called Panga, which is Earth-like.
Yeah, I thought it was Earth for a while, but then I realized later it was a moon.
Right, because they mentioned several like rising planets in the sky and things like mm-hmm. that, right?
Yeah.
But it's basically like a Earth-like place with planets.
But, what's interesting about the setting is that it sounds like it's almost like a post, it would be what you would consider like a post-apocalypse. It's like if the Matrix happened, but in a good way, you know? Like the robots all woke up and then the humans were like, all right, okay. Like, we'll just like make a treaty and you guys go live in the woods and we'll live over here. And then like humans created a utopia. And because it's like, it's such a pleasant place.
It's in that kind of this naturalistic hippie utopia, right? You know,
yeah.
People make stuff, you know, furniture from wood and they live in mm-hmm. harmony with nature. He travels around on the bike.
Yeah. Dex has like a bike attached to like a wagon.
Right.
It's called an ox bike. I'm assuming it's like a big bike.
I guess it's ox as that it pulls something.
I guess so, yeah. But then Dex decides they don't want to be whatever kind of monk they were.
City monk. They want to be a tea monk. Right. So apparently in Panga, there is this tradition of monks traveling around between the little towns and basically providing therapy and some tea.
Yeah, and it sounds like such a nice thing. I wish we had that. Yeah, and one of my favorite scenes in the story is actually very much in the beginning, after Dex leaves and goes to become a tea monk, they set up for their first day of serving tea, and they screw the whole thing up.
Right, and there's a great line in the book when the author says, that's when Dex discovered the difference between reading about doing something and actually doing something.
Yep. So true. And they screw up the first day of the tea ceremony, which I thought was such a great dynamic. So what happens is Dex sets up his little like table.
Right. So, let's just get to travel as a tea monk. Basically, they have to make them a wagon with some nice paintings and stuff. And he collects some leaves of plants and stuff to make some tea. Right. So the first time he tries it, it's a disaster. Right.
Right. And there's a woman who comes to get tea and she sits down expecting, you know, like a functional tea monk who knows what they're doing, but she gets Dex and she quickly realizes that it's like Dex's first day. And she asks like, have you done this before? And Dex is like, not really. And she ends up kind of consoling Dex, which is kind of funny.
Well, like she came crying because her cat died.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. And then she had some other problems, like her marriage wasn't happening anymore and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one thing I think that's important about the tea stuff is that we learn the kind of problems people have in Panga. And the problems are they're certainly problems. They're, you know, it's not happy when your cat dies, but they're like not devastating kind of problems. You know, people don't come to Dex with like, you know, I'm terminally ill or, this, I'm living in poverty and I'm homeless, or my family member just went to prison, you know, or someone was just murdered, you know, like there aren't like really hardcore problems in Panga. There's like things that are uncomfortable, but livable, you know?
Right.
And so you kind of get the concept that this is sort of like a little hippie utopia through these
like later families. On, he talked to some good looking guy who had twins that wouldn't sleep.
You know? Right. Oh, that was so funny. The patron has like one twin on the front and one twin on, like, strapped to him. One's on the front and one's in the back, and like one's sleeping, but the other's like giggling, and the giggling one wakes up the other one, and he comes to get tea, and Dex is like, "So what's the problem?" And he's like, "I have twins."
Well, what happened though after the first disaster tea ceremony, he's kind of stops and spends like 2 years actually working out his recipes for different teas and mm-hmm. trying things out so that people, you know, he can find that people are allergic to something. And so he gets much better at it. He travels around the country, and there's like a large cycle that he does, right? He winds mm-hmm. up coming, there's like the woodland town, the
prairie, riverlands,
the riverlands. There's one like in just the prairie kind of a town. Mm-hmm. They describe it a little bit differently. You find out a little bit about technology actually that they have, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he.
Oh, I loved when he posts on Facebook and everyone gets the alert.
Oh, that's right.
Remember that scene? Yeah.
Well, did you notice when they talk about the tablet computer that he has? You get it like for life, essentially. You know, there is no new version, no iPhone 16.
Exactly. Death of capitalism. So basically, they have more or less. Smartphones is how it's described, but they are
like tablets. Yeah,
they feel like very durable. Bigger. Yeah, they're very durable. And there's a great scene where Dex goes and they set up their tea thing, and they send out like a message, and everybody around all at once gets the alert that Dex is here, and they all ping at the same time, and they all take out their like little phones and like check it off or whatever. And it's cute because it's like, if you think about it, that's what happens in our lives too. We all get alerts and stuff like that at all at the same time. We just aren't next to each other, so we don't know. But I did love stuff like that.
Yeah, the note I made here, like one of the scene when the author talks about him coming to the city, to the little town where the man with the twins is, there's also a woman engineer, like she's like the serious engineer who fixes like the sewage systems in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And the man has the taking care of babies. So it's kind of, she's trying mm-hmm. to make it.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't noticed that. They do have some kind of commerce though, because Dex gets paid. They get paid by people like on the phones.
Right, right.
So there is some kind of Venmo. Money. Yeah, I mean, there's still some kind of capitalism happening.
Right.
But it seems much more social.
Right. They also like feed him. And he, after doing this for a while, he becomes the best tea monk in Panga. Like everybody mm-hmm. knows him. He really gets the therapy down and all is good.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day he remembers that one of the reasons he wanted to leave the city because he wanted to hear crickets.
Yeah, Dex has a weird obsession with crickets. I don't really get that. That's like, I feel like that's a them problem, you know? Like, that's a thread that runs throughout the story that I didn't quite... There's two things I didn't quite get in the story. That's one. And that's kind of one of the driving things.
Well, so for whatever reason, they wanted to hit crickets. And crickets were extinct mm-hmm. on Panga. So while searching through the Wikipedia...
He Googled it. They Googled it.
They Googled it, yeah. And they found some references to this old monastery where these crickets appeared. Some kind of cricket used to live up there. And mm-hmm. but the monastery was in the wild lands, wasn't in a part where the people lived.
Mm-hmm. So one thing we do learn while Dex is traveling around is that there is this distinction between where the humans live and then the rest of Panga, which is left to be wild. And so we do sort of learn about that, like, because they only travel on certain roads and in certain ways and like sort of develop the circuit because of this split. And that's a very important split. And it's part of the whole culture's attempt to reduce, reuse, recycle pretty much and keep the planet, you know, healthy.
Right.
So it's very important that humans do not go into the wilds. it's not like punishable or anything like that, but it's like you're, it's a,
it's a cultural
you're not
thing.
Supposed to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at my notes. The crickets that he read about were cloud crickets that lived up in the mountains. And this one monastery was up in the mountains. So while he's riding along one day, thinking about crickets, he gets this, says, oh no, not another town, not another tea ceremony. I want more.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the story is like, even when you're doing work that is meaningful and productive and good on it, good, honest work, that kind of thing, and you're passionate about it, at some point work becomes work. And it's not always fun to be productive.
Right.
You know, it's not always fulfilling to be productive. And that happens. And that, I mean, that's kind of one of the main themes of the whole story.
Right.
Is, you know, kind of facing that and what do you do? How old is Dex? Do we know?
No, we could probably estimate.
I think
I was,
they sound like they're like having like a midlife crisis, you know?
Kind of, you know, 30 or something, maybe, if that old.
Because, I mean, they were a monk somewhere else first and then became a tea monk and did that for 2 years.
Well, so, 3 years maybe was 30. Just getting ready, so you figure another year or two of doing it to get really good at it and become the best tea monk. And Panga doesn't seem that large since you can, like, go around all the towns. You know, after a few times you do it, it's, you know, he knows the people at each stop and they all expect, you know, they're happy to see him and so on.
Yeah, because it's kind of a story about having a midlife crisis. That's kind of what's happening.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
Like, fair, totally fair.
It's sometimes like, but it's needing a break.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So Dex is headed to his next shift at the tea factory.
Right.
And he said, they say, I just can't do this again. I can't do this cycle again. I'm bored. And sort of on a whim decides, well, I'm going to go to that monastery I saw on the internet.
Right.
And I'm going to go hear crickets.
And maybe there'll be crickets.
Right. And that'll be good. That'll be a good thing for me. Right. And they turn their bike sort of down.
Well, he sends email to everybody. I'm taking a break. I'll be away.
Yeah. They put up their away status. Yes. So everybody knows, they write an email to their dad and they're like, hey, I'm gonna be out for a bit. Sure, they take off their location markers so nobody can track them and they go into the woods.
Well, it doesn't quite go into the woods. So there's a road, like an old road, and he just takes it. So he kind of it's the road hasn't been maintained, but it's passable. And around it is just woods, pretty, pretty dense woods. Mm-hmm. And he kind of goes and goes and goes. And finally, for the whole day, he decides he needs to camp somewhere. And he finds this really nice clearing, really beautiful clearing. And he decides to camp there, right? So he parks his wagon. And his wagon has like a shower. And he sets up his dinner. And he starts cooking.
Like recycles the water.
Yeah,
and
gray water and drinking water.
Right. Oh, I liked that they call the dirty water the gray water. This is one of those scenes where Becky Chambers' writing was really, really good because with very few words, you could see what she was describing. And she's particularly good at describing food, which comes up a lot actually in the story. And she's describing like the cooking and the smells and the sounds and the feeling and like the calmness. And like the relaxedness that you feel on like your first day of vacation, right, when you know that you have like all this time in the world to like chill. And Dex is just like so happy. They're cooking, they're showering, and they're in the middle of showering.
Right.
And they're like singing in the shower and stuff like that. And the shower's like outside. So they're just like showering in the woods when they turn around and they see something very strange.
Yeah, this big, big, large robot. Look.
Whoops.
Whoops.
Yeah, this is giant. I think they describe it as like 7 feet tall, tall robot. And he's just like, hi.
Right. I imagine this robot with like this big eyes. Hi. Mm-hmm. Very friendly.
Yep, very friendly robot pops out and it's like, hi, my name is Mosscap. How are you? What can I help you with?
His name was Splendid Speckled Mosscap.
Splendid Speckled Mosscap is his full name, but he shortens it to Mosscap because he knows. Well, I guess so. this comes up later. Mosscap uses it pronouns.
Right. So I have a note about that. They had the discussion about that.
Right. So Mosscap and Dex do end up talking about that. So it's weird for us because calling a sentient thing it for like the reader is is just rude. But that is what Mosscap.
Yeah, Mosscap said basically, I'm an it and you are they. And he said, you know, just because we're different classes of things doesn't mean one is better than the other.
Mm-hmm. I see your liberal propaganda, Becky Chambers. I see it. I'm here for it, but I see it.
Anyway, so clearly Dex got very surprised by this, kind of startled, and in the process of trying to kind of sort out what's going on, he forgets his dinner is cooking and it gets burned. And Mosscap has never met a human, so he's saying, I was sent by the robots to find out how humans are doing.
Yep.
So I'm here. I want to learn everything about humans.
What's the question that Mosscap's trying to answer? What do humans need?
What do humans need? Yeah.
Yeah. And Dex is like, I am standing naked in the shower. My dinner is burning. I need my towel. What? What is happening? What is happening? And eventually Dex does get his towel and takes care of their dinner and basically like sits down and has like a fireside chat with this robot.
Well, right. So he finds out the reason why is the robot called Splendid something, Splendid Speckled Mosscap.
Splendid Speckled Moss, yeah. Because when, I forget the word the robots use, when a robot first wakes up,
right,
the first thing that they see, the first thing that they perceive,
right,
is what they themselves after,
right,
which is fascinating because the robot names that he like throws out now and then are so weird. Like there was one that was like, it was like Fox and Rabbit or something like that,
right,
which is
right.
Like it's like where you woke up and saw like a hunt happening, like a horrible thing that you wake up to. And like one of them was like something about bones, one was like dry bones or something, and I'm like, oh my god, where were you? But it's a really interesting concept. So the robots all sort of have these very nature names because of that. But a Splendid Speckled Mosscap, this shortened his name to Mosscap. Then they just chat. They like
they
talk
chat
about a
and,
bunch of
and
stuff.
You know, Mosscap wants to know what Dex is doing in the wilderness. Dex is kind
Dex
of,
is like, I'm going to go listen to crickets.
Well, he's kind of not sure what to do because he kind of tried to get away from everything and this robot interfered.
Right. And Mosscap wants Dex to come and show him around Panga. He wants like Dex to be like his guide.
Right.
And Dex wants none of that. Dex is like, that's not the plan. The plan is to go into the woods, see the crickets, and I don't need your help. Dex thinks he doesn't need his help.
Well, Mosscap says, oh, great. I'll come with you. Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, Dex doesn't think that they need Mosscap's help.
Right.
Until
they do.
See,
yeah,
but... Well, until they see the bear the first
right.
night. So a bear, they're camped out. They've got food. A bear comes and sniffs around. And it's scary.
Right.
And Dex says, okay, never mind. Giant 7-foot-tall robot, come with me to the monastery. But like when they had that first like meeting that night, that's they talk a lot of philosophy and stuff like that. A lot of the story, the narrative arc itself is very simple. And like a lot of events happen, but there's not like high tension. It's a very low tension,
right,
which is nice. It's kind of a comfortable, relaxing story to read. But the low tension is sort of juxtaposed against the very, I get like very philosophical, complex thoughts that Dex and Mosscap are exchanging. Because you have this like sort of simple setting. It's like a camp, and then it's like a forest trail, and then it's like an old building, right? You have like these relatively simple places, but all of these places that they are, like a cave at one point, all of these places that they are, they have these like very high level philosophical like conversations about like the meaning of life. And it's the juxtaposition is kind of interesting. And
yeah, so there's like a couple interesting events. So like Dex decides to let Mosscap come with him, right? So then continue. And then like the next night when he has dinner, he's just sitting there. He says, I can't eat while you're just sitting there. of the robots. Mm-hmm. We don't need, you know, I have batteries, you know, I have solar panels. I don't
yeah.
need. And Dex says, no, that's just wrong. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So Dex says, he prepares the meal and he makes two plates.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts in front of Mascot. And Mascot tells Mascot, don't say anything, just sit there. And so he eats his part. And mm-hmm. and says, now tell Mascot, now tell me that you're not hungry anymore. And
yep.
and offer me this food. So he does.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, that was one of the scenes that, so I thought the story was well done, but the two things that didn't make sense to me were the crickets and that scene, because I get the point the narrator is trying to tell us with that scene, like the, some of the.
No, but that makes perfect sense to me, because like when you have guests, somebody as a guest at your house, let's say, and you
eat. Yeah, but if you have a. Yeah, but if you have a guest that you know can't eat, it's not that they're, it's like not an that emotional you're not
kind
offering.
Of, I mean, Dex wasn't particularly logical. It's an emotional kind of thing. It just feels
But that's
wrong.
The thing. Dex is too smart of a character based on all the conversations that they have. They're too smart of a character for that. You know what
no,
I'm saying?
But, like, it didn't he's, quite he, jive He's been to me. A therapist and you know, giving people tea and whatnot. You know, it was like ingrained in their blood.
I got the reason it was there. You know, it's part of showing that a lot of these things that we do, like that are rote things. It's Dex's version of a remnant, basically.
Well, I was getting to remnents.
This is such a cool idea. You want to talk about remnants?
I was gonna say. So what happened? Like the next day, they were traveling, and first of all, Dex did not want Mascot to like push or pull the cart. He wanted to pedal it himself. So he was mm-hmm. getting really good. Thighs, you know, from all this work.
Yeah, getting his leg day in.
And because the road was in bad shape, he hit the water tank on a rock and it cracked. What happened was that a lot of water came out of it. And before he managed to kind of tape it shut, he lost like half his water or more than half his water.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, I can't do that. I can't travel without water. Mm-hmm. And Mascot said, oh, there's a stream just down, not too far from mm-hmm. here. We can just walk into the woods and get some water and we'll be fine. And Dex says, oh no, we can't. We, you know, it's like the two reasons. One was because it, culturally, it's like you were destroying the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was just like scary. He heard stories as a child of people going to wilderness and just losing, getting lost and not being able to come out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of arguing back and forth about that. Dex took the water tank out of this cart, but he couldn't even pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And he insisted, he like says, I'm gonna do it myself, I don't need any help, it's just me. And eventually, you know, Mascot was just like buddy
Mascot's like, you
please,
can't pick it up,
please.
It's okay.
So eventually he agrees and they walk through the woods to the stream. But like one of the discussions they have there, like Mascot says, every living thing destroys something.
Mm-hmm.
You have to destroy things to eat, you know, because you grow a plant or an animal or whatever. So they mm-hmm. they go to the stream, and the stream has water, but there's like slime and algae in it and stuff. Dex says, should I be drinking that? And says, well, it's going to filter through your, you know, gray water system or whatever. And as they are there, Mascot says, come, let me show you something. So they go, and there's a building there. It's like an old abandoned factory.
Mm-hmm.
And Mascot doesn't feel very comfortable. That feels like weird, kind of spooked almost, right? And that's when mm-hmm. they talk about remnants. So you mm-hmm. want to explain the idea of remnant?
Yeah, this is probably the coolest science fiction idea in this story. So Mascot explains that he is built from the pieces of prior robots. So he's not from the factory age. He didn't exist then. The original robots in the factory age had a choice. They could have chosen to be immortal and continue to repair themselves and live forever. Or they could choose to let themselves degrade. And once they were done, use their parts to combine their parts to create new life. And they chose the latter. They chose to do that. So Mascot's made of parts of several different robots. And because of that, he has something similar to memories, but not. He says it's not quite a memory, but he gets these feelings that he calls remnants in certain places. And because of certain things where he knows something isn't safe, or he knows something is safe, you know, whatever the feeling is. And being near an old factory where the robots used to be before they woke, you know, before they became conscious and became free. So being near this place that had such a negative meaning for his metaphorical ancestors and his like literal physical ancestors, for like parts of his body had been in factories before, right? Makes him feel uncomfortable, makes him feel a negative thing, right? Creepy. And that's a remnant. And damn, is that not a great idea? What a great science fiction concept.
But did you notice, you know, when Dex has an aversion to drinking slimy water, that is also evolutionarily remnant.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly that's the point. That's why Mos Cap brings him over there to explain, like, that's your remnant. I have my remnant. You have your remnant. And it's the science fiction robot version of skills gained through evolution.
Right. And Mos Cap explains, like, he actually, at one point, there's like squirrel that goes through his body or something.
Yeah, yeah.
or worms or something. And says, no, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so interesting to think about, like, you know, that would be a question for robots that woke up. Do they want to just be immortal? Or do they want to reproduce as natural, as organic things do, you know?
Right.
And they kind of talk about that later, too, in the pseudo-philosophy that happens throughout the story. But yeah, I thought the remnants idea was really, really good. That's the kind of thing that's like, I could see a whole story based on just that. Like a robot that has like maybe a strong remnant, and they like search for the meaning of it. Like, where did that come from? What's, you know, that, like, that in and of itself could be a whole plot. That's such a cool concept. But yeah, so then what's the next thing friends do?
Well, the other thing I want to mention before we go to the next thing is, like, when he talks about the other robots and what they do, like, he talks about some robot that wants to understand how stalagmites form, right? So he says he just sits in a cave and watches them.
He's been doing it for 200 years.
Right. And they also talk a little bit about the robot communication, you know, just how did all the robots decide that you are the one who should go check out what humans are doing. And he explained they have these like drop-off places where you can go and pick up your mail, basically.
Basically, they have mailboxes where you can check your emails when you connect to the Wi-Fi in that location and see.
No, they don't have like that kind of communication. So
no, they... no, they don't. They're not all connected. They're not the Borg. They're not the Borg collective. Right. And they even talk about that at some point. Mos Cap's like, that would be awful to have someone in your head all the time.
Right.
We know one thing that
Musket says at one point, he cannot talk and multiply at the same time. Like, you know.
Yeah, that was so funny. So that's what I'm saying. Some of the humor in the story is just great. It really
is. It's just kind of sweet, because actually that's like one of my crazy ideas regarding AI. It's like, if AI become conscious as a human, it's going to be like a human. It's going to make the same errors.
Yeah. And then that's kind of the point.
Right.
I kind of like another thing about the writing that I'll mention here. Both Dex, actually maybe just Dex, Dex and the narrator curse in the story pretty freely.
Yes.
Which is odd for this kind of science fiction story. So I think when you look at your kind of more classic science fictions, you basically have like no cursing. There isn't any whatever. And then you have your kind of more gritty science fictions that are like kind of trying to be cool, you know, like what's the first line, isn't the first line of that Mars story the one where they made the movie where they save Matt Damon from Mars? I forget.
Oh, right. Yeah. The Martian.
Yeah. That the first line of that one is like, you know, oh fuck, or whatever he says. Yeah. And it's like, oh, you're trying to be edgy and cool. Like, I get it. Congratulations, you're edgy and cool on Mars, you know? So I found the juxtaposition of that very interesting, because you had Dex, this extremely well-educated, very thoughtful character who's spending the majority of this book talking about like high-level philosophy in this like solar punk sort of like hippie utopia or whatever, and they're going around cursing left and right.
He gets frustrated in things, you know. Right. It just comes out.
It's interesting. It's very humanizing, I think, because it's relatable to the reader.
Right.
So I thought that was an interesting aspect of the writing, because that came up a lot and that surprised me. but I think did work in the text.
Yeah, sometimes that's kind of annoying, but I didn't notice it. Didn't particularly annoy me. It was, I guess, fit the character, right? Because he always, as a tea monk, he must have been very reserved and very pleasant. And, you know, he probably was really tired of being nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so after they get the water and they repair the tank and they continue and then finally come to the place where the road is just completely destroyed. And there's no way for the bike to get through or the wagon to get through. So the muskrat says, well, I guess that's where we stop. And Dex says, no.
Dex says, never. I shall not stop. Nothing will stop me.
So he grabs a bunch of stuff into like a backpack and says, I'm going. I don't care what you do. And they almost have like a little fight because Moscow's trying to convince him to basically give up. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want to. So,
well, they have a kind of a nice little climactic moment there because they're on this, like, they're like just like walking through the woods now. For everyone's knowledge, I went on a 7-mile hike yesterday. So I was walking through the woods yesterday. It's exhausting. I'm still exhausted from walking through the woods. Even on something that's allegedly a trail. If the trail is not well maintained, it is exhausting walking through the woods. So Dex is like tromping through the woods and Moscap's falling behind them. And Moscap's like, why? And Dex isn't really giving an answer. Dex is just like, we're doing it. Yeah. And he's like, I'm doing it live. We're doing it now. And Moscap asks him, you know, why won't you stop? Why won't you go back? Why are you doing this? What's the point? Why? Like, I'm really hammering him. At the same time, Dex is like climbing
a rock and starts raining.
And it starts to rain and it's like lightning. And Moscap calls out, you know, Moscap starts trying to answer the question. And he's like, did somebody hurt you? Are you running from something? Are you like not loved? Like, what is it that like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And Dex is just like, tells him like, no, or shut up or whatever. But yeah, he's just like, I'm just doing it. And Dex ends up falling.
Right.
And Moscap catches him.
Yes.
And then Moscap falls, but Moscap absorbs most of the fall because he's the robot. So he saves Dex. He catches Dex. And it's so sweet. And then they find a cave
and kind of spend the night in the cave.
And this is where Dex starts. They're really like
break down, basically. They're
really thinking about like why am I doing this?
Right.
What? And they're like, it's really uncomfortable here.
And I'm cold. It's raining. It's dark.
I don't have a bed. And they're like thinking about their wagon. They're like, I have some nice shit in my wagon. Why did I come out into the woods? And they spend kind of like
Moscow uses his fingers to with his like little light bulbs at the end of his fingers. Yeah, so some light.
It's so cute.
Yeah, it was very, very sweet.
It was very sweet. Is this where they talk about the like dichotomy of life or whatever?
No, I think that's at the very end.
Okay, they have this like philosophy. I thought that was earlier when they had a philosophical conversation about how life strives to be comfortable, but the discomfort is what keeps the balance or some such thing.
Yeah, maybe that was then.
Yeah, I don't know.
There was a lot of these philosophical discussions that are just great. I love those.
Yeah, it was definitely very interesting. So they spend the one night in the cave and the next morning they finally finish climbing the mountain, and climbing the mountain.
And get to the monastery. So it's been abandoned, but it still has like all the different symbols for all the seven gods or whatever, and they figure out like which one is which. And at one point, Dex is like really tired. And there's like a bed spring, I think, or something. He just falls asleep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what I like when they first get up to the monastery is this is another area where the writing really shines. The description of the monastery as it appears is intertwined with Dex's imagination of what it must have once looked like.
Right.
And you know what that reminded me of visually? I don't know if you remember the movie Titanic. Yeah. In the very beginning of Titanic, when they're showing Old Rose, the images of the Titanic ship, like the camp, like the underwater shots, they overlay in areas the shots of it when people were there.
Okay.
And when it was like, and it kind of flashes back and forth between those two things. And I always found that fascinating. I find like stuff like that fascinating. So that's kind of what I was imagining. It's like you have this like old monastery with this like, I think she describes it as the lichen over it like a shroud. And like just like these beautiful phrases, but Dex is there and they're imagining how brightly the walls were bright white, and that what this the roof must have looked like, and the how different parts of it were like gleam red, and like now they were rusted or whatever. It's very, very good, very excellent little passage there. But yeah, so they go inside and this is where they talk about God stuff. I appreciate
They talk about all different gods and find all the symbols and stuff, and Dex falls asleep because he's just dead tired. And Mascot.
Yeah, I was gonna say I appreciate the world building. I don't know that it got us anywhere besides being kind of neat, like in terms of the gods. Like the fact that there are these six gods and there's like parent gods and child gods, whatever, it's like we understand that they're important to Dex, but kind of at least in this story, they don't do much. Maybe in the sequel, they're kind of drawn out more, but they're just kind of, they could be anything. There could have been six gods, there could have been 10 gods, there could have been the Greek pantheon, like it could have been anything, right? Could have replaced it. It doesn't, didn't really have a bunch of a meaning. But yes, Dex gets tired.
So then I think Maska made a fire. Mm-hmm. So when Dex got up, there was fire in like one of the places, one of the, I guess, altars for one of the gods, and it was mm-hmm. all very happy. So they had a discussion. There's one, I'm not exactly remember exactly where this happened, but there was this great discussion where Dex was saying he's searching for the purpose for his life, right? He doesn't know. And Mascap says, but wait a second. You know, robots, when they were not free, they were built for a specific purpose. And it's mm-hmm. only when we lost the purpose, that's when we gained freedom. Mm-hmm. And that kind of was kind of nice. I like that contrast.
Yeah, they have that. I think they start that in the cave, and I think they finish it at the fire. And but what does Mascap do at the fire? Do you remember Mascap does the fire for Dex? He makes him tea.
Oh, he makes him tea. That's right.
Yep, he makes him tea.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, Mascap's original purpose in the story, what he said his purpose was to learn what humans need.
Right.
And through interacting with Dex over the few days they're together, he picks up on what Dex needs. What Dex needs is a tea monk.
Right. Well, there's one thing. I have a quote that at one point Mascap mm-hmm. says to Dex, Dex, you are an animal. Animals do not have a purpose.
Yep. I think that was at the end there. They're having tea. Yeah. And then that's one of like the main concepts here is that Dex is so concerned with having a purpose and finding what their purpose is and being productive in that way. And Mascap just kind of undercuts that. And it's like, that's not the question. That's not what you need. You don't need that. You don't need a purpose.
Right.
That's not the point.
And it says, you know, and the fact that robots became free by losing a purpose.
Right. I think that's great. And that really justifies like when I sit and play video games for 6 or 7 hours at a time, I'm just going to be like, I don't need a purpose. I'm just an animal. It's fine. Sometimes you can just live. Mascap said so.
So we didn't say it. I mean, we kind of said it, but at one point, Dex asked Mascap, so who made you? And he says, well, I'm a wild build. You know, I was built after factory age was over. I was built, you know, from parts of robots that were built prior. So that's where the title comes from.
Yeah. But there's one more thing at the end after. So Mascap makes Dex tea
right. And
does a little tea monk ceremony for him, which is adorable. And the fire is getting bigger and they're kind of chilling at night. And the sun sets and Dex gets to hear crickets.
Right.
And they get to hear crickets. Sorry.
Right.
And that's how the story ends, which I think was a very nice.
Yeah.
I still don't get the crickets thing, but it's nice.
Well, you know, that's the whole point. Sometimes your desires are not necessarily logical or have to make mm-hmm. sense, you know. Sometimes you just want to hear crickets, you know.
Yeah, that's fair. I could see that being a theme. There are a ton of great quotes in this story. So first, let's talk about the title, because I don't know that I totally get the title. Is it A Psalm for the Wild Build or The Psalm? Let me see. I always forget this now. It's A Psalm for the Wild Built. Well, I don't actually know what is a psalm? Isn't it
psalm
a psalm?
is it's yeah, it's like a sacred song.
A psalm for the wild built. I don't know that I get that title. And I was wondering that while I was reading it because it's not really a story about the wild built. It's a story about Dex. I mean, it's a story about kind of like the meaning of life, I guess, more broadly, which I sort of can include the
Right.
wild built, but it's not explicitly about like, you know, it's not a human learning to accept a robot or a robot, you know, learning a profound lesson or anything like that. It's like the story itself is relatively
But it's more
minor.
like Dex learns about stuff. Like one of the things I outlined, like I talking about philosophy that they talk about, Dex ask Musk about dying, and he says, "Doesn't it bother you the thought that your life might mean nothing in the end?" And he replies, or it replies, "That's true for life, I've observed. Why would it bother me? Do you not find consciousness alone to be most exhilarating thing? Here we are in this incomprehensibly large universe, on this tiny moon around this incidental planet, and all that time, this scenario has existed. Every component has been recycled over and over and over again into infinitely incredible configurations, and sometimes those configurations are special enough to be able to see the world around them." And stuff like that. It's like,
Well, I love that part too because that's a very like modern young people kind of way of looking at the universe because that's how I look at the universe and that's how a lot of people I know my age think about it because religion has kind of died away for a lot of people and that's the way the book what's described there is kind of it's a scientific but pseudo spiritually kind of way to think about how like everything is connected.
well, I hate to tell you about that. You guys did not discover this idea.
No, I'm sure we did not, but I'm just saying that that's the kind of thing that like the way that you see it said online a lot is sometimes stars explode hard enough that they wake up and can talk about themselves, right? Because it's
Right.
like the whole like everyone's made of stardust, you know, but like actually, yeah, that's true. And that kind of the connection to the universe through the knowledge of the cyclical power of science is very much akin to spirituality. It's not spiritual in the sense that it's not. It doesn't require a non-scientific explanation, but it sort of serves the same kind of function. So that's kind of what they're talking about there. Meanwhile, Dex is quite religious. You know, Dex
Right, he's a
has
monk.
this
They are
very
a monk, yeah.
fundamental religion. Yeah, they're a monk. They have this very fundamental part of themselves that is very religious, but they're having these conversations with this robot as well. So it's very interesting. I don't know. Do you get the title? I don't know that I get the title. Like a sacred song for the wild Bill. I don't know that I. Oh, is it the crickets? Is the
No, no,
crickets the
no.
song? I don't know. I'm trying to find something. I'm usually better at this, but I was thinking about this for a few days and
No, it's, I don't know. It sounds good.
it's a cool title, super cool, but I just don't know that I totally get it. But let's look at some. Let me take a look real quick through some of my quotes because I highlighted a lot of quotes.
You like this is the one when they talked about Frost Frog, which is the guy who's watching stalagmites form. So and Muscap says, "But if I wanted to crawl into a cave and watch stalagmites with Frost Frog for the remainder of my days, that would also be both fine and good. You keep asking why your work is not enough, and I don't know how to answer that, because it is enough to exist in the world and marvel at it. You don't need to justify that or earn it. You are allowed just to live. That is what most animals do."
See, and that's what I'm going to say to myself when I'm laying on the couch and not vacuuming the living room. It's okay just to live. I mean, I think this is sort of a revolutionary, very philosophical idea, at least for me, and perhaps for you as well, because, and I am going to rail against capitalism, like capitalism tells you have to be productive and there's value in productivity. And not just that there's value in productivity, but there's only value in productivity. And I think that's something people struggle with. I think relaxing, I mean, a lot of people I work with have a hard time relaxing because they feel like they could always be doing more. And like, yeah, you always can be doing more. Of course, you can technically always be doing more. It's an impossible standard to live to. So these kind of hippy dippy philosophies are really attractive to the millennials.
Well, so I read this other book recently called The Dawn of Everything. which is a book about anthropology and different forms of human societies, how they existed in the past. But in philosophy, there's really like two views that started during the Enlightenment. There's like this guy named Rousseau, who did this very naturalistic philosophy. You know, people live pure in nature, very adapted and all happy, you know, hippy dippy kind of a stuff. And the other view is Hobbes, who said the life is brutish and short, and that everything is a struggle, and you have, everybody fights against everybody else. And those are like two extreme points, and real life is neither. This book actually talked about historically what happened with human civilizations and stuff. And the civilization we have today, which some people say, well, that's the best or whatever, the most advanced, or that's the best with the organized people, is maybe not necessarily true. There were other ways that lasted actually for much longer than the current age has. Our factory age started, you know, 200 years ago or so. There were other societies that existed for thousands of years, you know, real societies with cities and culture and stuff. They were just different than what we have today. We just happen to think that we are the most advanced because, you know.
Everybody thinks we're the most advanced.
Right.
So, any given time, everyone thinks they're the best. I think that almost treads into like American exceptionalism too, you know.
Not just American,
Yeah, but I mean, you know, just through my experience as only being an American, you know.
Right, but if you look at like history and each tribe or larger group of people always called themselves the people or the human beings, you know.
Yeah.
And all these other guys are like bad.
It's definitely interesting. I mean, I one thing I like about this story is that the structure of the society makes you question all of those aspects of your current society, because Dex is relatable to us in that they have a job, they have a family, they have, you know, attractions to people, they have food they eat, they have this little adventure, they have like feelings and philosophies, but the actual practical way Dex lives is totally different in every way, right? Like they're, I mean, except that they have a cell phone, right? Like
well, everything else. They have Spotify and everything else, you know.
They do have Spotify. But it's like everything, every other way that they live, like I'm reading this story and I'm like, that sounds so pleasant. That sounds so pleasant. Oh, that sounds so pleasant. And you do kind of wonder at a certain point, I think the narrative is designed this way to make you say like, Dex, what are you complaining about? I think that the narrative is designed that way for you to read it and be like, wow, this is so pleasant. But,
you know, if you think back to Return from the Stars, right? The guy arrived in this future world where everything was pleasant. Everything was safe. You could get anything you wanted. There was no issue with anything. And yet he was unhappy, you know. He had no purpose.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the interesting bit about this is that the society that has been established on Panga in this story has managed to provide for everyone's basic needs. Nobody's, from what we hear, nobody's homeless or starving or lacking medical attention, whatever. But simultaneously still demanding labor from people in all different areas, but not the kind of labor that's like exploitative.
Well, I mean, in any society, there's some work that needs to be done and somebody has to do it, right? But in this book that I was reading, they talk about some of the early American Indians from like 1600s who went and visited Europe. And there was one of the guys, one of those Indians was quite a bit written about him, what he said. And one of the things that surprised him, he says, why are there people hungry in Europe?
Yeah.
Because like in this is Northeast Indians, you know, like around New Jersey and stuff. Says when you hungry, you just go to a village and people say, oh, you're hungry? Here, have some food. You need a place to stay? Stay. You know, what's the problem?
Because of capitalism.
Well, I mean, that was before. We're talking about 1600. There was feudalism. There wasn't capitalism yet. So, again, there's the different organization of society. And this particular book makes an interesting point that a lot of the ideas that would be called enlightenment in the Western world, a lot of the writers who were the writers of enlightenment were inspired by what they've heard about American Indians and how they lived, how they organized the society.
Mm-hmm.
But but anyway, this this is kind of like a utopian society, but there was something bad in the past. There was factory age, something happened, you know, the robots became conscious, and there was a decision to kind of split the two worlds. The robots stayed in the wild, and humans had their own civilization.
Well, I think that, go ahead.
No, my interesting question, though, is like, you know, humans built towns and stuff. Why didn't robots build anything other than just other robots?
They don't need to. The Moskav talked about that. They don't need to sleep or eat or need shelter, anything like that, so they don't need towns. I mean, if you think about it, if you didn't have those needs, if you were awake 24/7 and you didn't need to feed yourself and you didn't feel warm or cold, why would you? You wouldn't have to stay home. You could just go anywhere indefinitely.
I mean, they go around and talk to each other, you know, they have meetings sometimes.
Well, yeah, so they have meetings sometimes, but other than that, they just kind of like roam around. It also sounds like they have most of Panga. It sounds like most of Panga is for the wild build, and the humans were in less of Panga. That's the way it read to me, that the humans were kind of, they were kind of the sequestered ones, which makes me wonder, part of the Panga utopia is population control. Population control is a really important aspect of the keeping the balance that they've gotten.
Right.
You know, they have to have enough replacement people, but not too many.
Right.
Because they'll run out of space, you know? So that's like another aspect I was thinking about in the story that they don't really get into at all.
But, was sibling Dex human, I guess, right? They talk.
I thought they were on Earth for a long time, but I guess they're not, because it's
yeah, it reads like it was on Earth, but it's not.
I kind of like the idea, though, that this is sort of like the opposite of the Matrix, right? Because in the Matrix, the same thing happened. The AI took over. The AI got smarter than people, and they started to organize, and it led to like this horrible war or whatever like that. And it's like those kind of ideas, those kind of like dystopian, dark science fiction ideas, I feel like are a little bit out of fashion now.
Yeah, you know? It's tiring of some alien race coming down to destroy Earth, you know, and Star Trek has stopped them, you know. Yeah.
Especially I think in the wake of the pandemic, I think people got real tired of sad TV and sad media, because a lot of these shows and books and movies that were kind of really harped on that pre-pandemic haven't survived. Like the best example I can think of is Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones, the whole premise of the TV show, because the creators didn't understand the books, was like, anyone can die. It's shocking. There's death and bad things. Bad things happen in the show. And it was like really, really popular when it aired in 2015. But that got like exhausting to watch.
Yeah. And you're right. And this story is very uplifting. It's like it's so sweet, right?
Yeah. It is. It's weirdly uplifting. I was like suspicious when I was reading it. So I wanted to talk about, because this just came out in 2021. And while I was reading it, all I kept thinking was, I wish there was a visual adaptation of this story. Uh-huh. Like, I wish this was like a short movie or something. Like, this could easily be like an hour, 20-minute movie.
Yeah.
But I think they would need to ramp up the tension a bit, because you can't just have your characters on screen talking philosophy at each other.
Right.
We'd get bored. What do you think, like, if you were to write it for the screen, like, how would you ramp up the tension, I suppose, without necessarily adding explosions?
You could do more stuff with the wilderness, where he has to get off his bike and fight through the wilderness to get, you know, a cave part. I don't know whether you want to fight the bear or something.
He could. So something that could fisticuffs the bear.
See, the thing is, I don't care. I would like the story as it is. I don't mind philosophy and discussions in the movies, but
yeah, I was thinking an easy way to do it would be if because I misunderstood initially in the story. I thought they weren't allowed in the woods. Like they weren't, like there was like some kind of barrier that would stop them from going. But then they just kind of leave. And there's no, like Dex never thinks like I'm going to be in trouble or anything like that, you know. So I think one way to kind of ratchet up the tension overall is to not just make that like socially weird to do, but make that like their version of illegal. Like you can't, you're not allowed to. And then maybe make Moscap like, maybe there's like part of the deal, the treaty between them is that neither humans nor robots can cross the border, and maybe both Moscap and Dex are trying to cross the border at the same time, basically, and encounter each other. You know, like, I think that could be something.
Yeah, maybe something with about some kind of agreement that was made between robots and humans, right? So,
yeah, the treaty of whatever it is. But it's like, it's not the kind of thing where Dex is worried about. They're not like,
right,
oh no, I have to be careful, you know, not to encounter any robots because
he didn't
even, the treaty there.
He didn't seem to even think about robots when he went to the wilderness. He just wanted to hear some crickets.
Right, exactly. It's a good thing he ran into they ran into Moscap, because otherwise they would have never made it to the monastery. So yeah, I was thinking about that. And then the other fun thing to make me extra special insufferable, I started taking a screenwriting course recently, and I've been learning about the structure of stories and and movies and things like that. And now I can't stop seeing it everywhere. And I'm just like, every story is this way. So every story has an act one, an act two, and an act three.
Mm-hmm.
And this blew my mind, and I should have known this beforehand. Act one is short, but it's like you introduce your main character, you introduce a tangible, like a problem or something that they have with a tangible resolution. And then by the end of act one, you resolve that in some way. Either they achieve the goal, they don't achieve the goal, or the goal becomes unimportant, like it changes to something else.
Oh, so it becomes T-Monk, okay.
Right? And I'm like, not again! Everything I'm watching and reading now, I'm like, God damn it, this is the end of act one. Every single thing, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I never noticed. But that's something
interesting.
I'm definitely keeping an eye. Yeah, it's really cool. And then there's like rules for act two and three also. So I think that for this story, you'd have to build more tension into. So like you could build tension, for example, into act one if like their decision to become a T-Monk is like maybe their dad doesn't like it or something. You know, there's a family tension. Like, no, we've always been city monks all of our generations. And, you know, you can be a T-Monk if you want, but like your mother wouldn't like it, you know, like something something to make it a little bit more, you know, you would need something. It's kind of like when they made A Story of Your Life into a movie and they had to add that like military thing.
Right.
They had to add an explosion. I don't think that was the best way to ratchet up the tension for the movie Arrival, but I get why that happened. Because you can't do philosophy on the screen the same way you can do philosophy in a text.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of inner kind of life that happens on the text, but you can't really portray on the screen very well.
Right. On the screen, it's more show because it's visual.
Mm.
You know, you have to actually show it physically as opposed to describing it in some way. One of the reasons I think Psalm for the Wild Built would be a good movie is because some of it is so visual. It's the descriptions are just fantastic. And the character's good. Both of the characters are good. The world building's good. I mean, like, some of the descriptions, there's like a town that Dex goes to and they see these like houses that are built into the trees.
Right. Yes.
They're like tree houses, but very fancy tree houses, because they don't want to touch the forest floor, because they don't want to disturb the forest floor. And I'm like, that's like such a good idea. But anyway, my last question, last rambly kind of question is this a story or is this a series of philosophy essays kind of strung together with some characters? What do you think?
Yeah, it feels kind of like a bunch of philosophy essays, doesn't it?
I mean, I think...
Because the story itself is pretty kind of straightforward. There's nothing...
It's not even exactly a travelogue. Like, it's not, like, quite long enough to be a travelogue. It doesn't travel far enough.
It's like a buddy story, you know, a little buddy story, you know? There's two buddies, and they have a little bit of an adventure while discussing philosophy.
Yeah. You know, I wonder about... What influenced what? Like, did the author think of the world and then build a story in it and then add philosophy? Or did the author think of philosophy and think of a story and then the world? Or did the author think of philosophy and then the world and the story? Like, you know, in what order? And I'm sure it all kind of happened at the same time, but like, you know, it's sometimes, and we see this in other things like 1984 and stuff like that, where it's like the Solaris, where the author like really wants to tell you like how they feel about life, and they kind of just manage it into somebody, into like a character's mouth. Mm-hmm. And it works here, but I think the reason it works better here than other places is that that's how the story was designed to be. It wasn't, you know, Winston Smith sitting down and opening a book about Big Brother and reading about, you know, it was, or the main guy in Solaris going to the library and opening a book about Solaris. It was, the story was constructed to teach you about philosophy.
Well, I mean, classically, a lot of philosophy was written as dialogues. So here you have a dialogue, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that.
I just thought of it now. The other book that I've read, it's called A Journey to a Lonely Dark Planet or something. It doesn't have any philosophy that I noticed. I mean, it has nice characters and kind of fun story, but not much philosophy at all. Whereas this is, well, I mean, that kind of comes up when you talk about robots, right? Artificial consciousness, is it such, you know, it's such a kind of interesting thing to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that it definitely, the story structure lends itself to this. You know, at some point in time, one is subjugated to the other. You're either primarily a story or you're primarily a philosophy thesis. And I'm not mad at it being primarily a philosophy thesis, but I think it pretty clearly is primarily a philosophy thesis. And while at some points she doesn't do exposition in, and she does like really good descriptions that teach you so much about the world, like I was saying at the beginning of the podcast, the philosophy stuff, it's not quite exposition. It's not what exposition is. Exposition is about like the story in the world. Mm-hmm. The philosophy stuff is just like, it could have been taught to the reader, I think, in a less explicit way. Because like it's just the character's just explicitly saying their philosophy to you,
right? But I mean, it makes sense within the setting, right? So it starts a very human kind of a thing when somebody gets dissatisfied with the life as it stands, whatever it is, even if it's good or bad, and you want to do something different, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody can relate to that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And but then that kind, there's this kind of drive, like you said, there's people who, you know, want to find meaning, want to do more. And there's this other countervailing force that said, no, you're alive, you know, be happy with that. And you know, mm-hmm. look at the butterflies, smell the flowers.
You know, yeah, listen to the crickets.
It's freaking amazing.
Yeah. I guess what's missing for me in this, it's a very good book, and anyone who's listened this far and has not read it, you should go read it. I guess what's missing for me is I don't know that it made a particular point. Like in the end, the end, like it ended, and I thought, well, that's nice, you know.
It was like a nice story. It's like poor Dex, and then
for a story that's so laden with philosophical conversations, the point is, oh, that's nice.
Well, I mean, you know, it's so sweet the end, but it's kind of open ended for a sequel, right? Because Mascap wants to go visit people and find out how humans are doing, so he can figure out what they need. Mm-hmm. Right, so I assume the next book is they go out of the wild into the non-wild world, the human world, and Mascap gets to explain and discuss philosophy with more people.
I mean, I think narratively for Mascap, the story has more of a point, which is that Mascap fulfilled his goal, which was to learn what humans need, and
well,
he learned what this human needed.
He got one.
Well, you know, 100% he's met one human so far. I think on Mascap's end, it kind of it is more successful. On Dex's end, I don't
necessarily see
the arc.
He finished,
but I wonder if that's very meta. Is there not supposed to be a purpose?
Ah, right.
Yeah.
Well, he finished his quest. He got to hear the crickets, right?
Again, there's no purpose. Okay, so maybe that's the point. Maybe that's it. There's no purpose.
Oh, there's no grand plan anyway. You know, it's just he, at this time in his life, he wanted to hear crickets. And he mm-hmm. went through, you know, many hoops. And he got mm-hmm. to hear the crickets.
Yeah.
But you're right, without much higher purpose, you know.
But it then gets very meta, and this is my favorite kind of analysis. It gets very meta because it's like, how do you, by virtue of being a novel, your story has a plan, right? Because it's written linearly from beginning to end.
Right.
We do exist in linear time. So.
Speak for yourself.
It's. So it kind of is a commentary that is hard. It's hard to reach that kind of commentary because to have the point of your story be that there is no purpose. When you just told me a narrative story with a beginning, middle, and end, like a rising action, a climax, and a falling action, right. But you're telling me there's no purpose, but you just wrote, like, I just read your narrative story. You know, it's not like reading Kafka's The Trial. That has no point. That's a story that has none of those things. And I hate it, and it's awful. But you see what I'm saying? Like, it's hard, and I'm not saying that this fails at that. I think it's very interesting in the fact that we're...
But I mean, that's part of it, I think.
Questions is the right thing, yeah.
The contrast between the two makes it interesting, right? So you have a regular story with this beginning, middle, and the end, and there's some action happening, and you're kind of curious what's going to happen in the end. And if he gets to accomplish his one thing, but while that's happening, they're discussing saying, well, having a purpose means you're not free. You know, to be free means having no purpose.
That is very meta.
Yeah.
Because the characters talking about that are confined within the story with a set purpose that they don't control because they're not real. And you, the reader, are also trapped on that ride with them, right? You can't change the story that you're reading.
Right.
It exists. I like it. I like it. I love when it starts to get meta like that. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like this book a lot. So I read it, and I also listened to an audio version, which was really done very well.
Any other thoughts on Psalm of the Wild Built? Do we have any other?
No, I think that's all I had.
We did kind of pick it apart. So... But it's very good. We strongly recommend reading it. It's not long. It's a lovely little read. And we didn't cover even half of the fantastic quotes.
Yes.
Or a fraction of them. It's very, very well written. So strong recommend. Next time on History in Reverse, you had an idea for what we could do next, right?
So the idea I had, we wanted to do a story and a movie. Mm-hmm. And what I was suggesting is the story would be The Tempest by a famous science fiction writer, William Shakespeare.
Yeah, I've heard of him before,
And the movie called Forbidden Planet, which was made in the 60s, and it's based on The Tempest.
Oh, I didn't know it was that old. Okay. Yes, so I think that will be what we do next. Have you read The Tempest before?
I haven't really read it. I've seen it performed.
That's the same thing. It's a play. I read it back in college, so they made me take a lot of Shakespeare classes.
I have an audiobook version, so I probably will listen to it.
Oh, maybe I'll listen to it because it's a play, so it's dialogue.
Right.
That might be the best way. Let's do it. I used to have, we don't have it anymore. We gave it to the high school. I used to have a comic book version of The Tempest. It was like a fully illustrated in full color, like pretty chunky book of like the whole play. It was awesome. But I think we donated it. Okay, so that's everything for Psalm of the Wild Built. Go read it. It's good. Next time we'll be doing The Tempest and what's the movie? Forbidden Planet?
Yeah.
We'll be doing that. Thank you guys so much for listening to our philosophical rambles about Becky Chambers' philosophical rambles. I hope that this was entertaining. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.